Hello, everyone. Good morning. I am your host, Jason Miles, and this is Revolution Podcast. Thank you guys for joining me in another episode. I wish more of you were there for the live show. I wish you guys could participate in the conversation, the wacky goings-on that happen when Toure Reed comes on the show. This episode is one that's been a long time coming. There was an article that we all read, and you know, we all read it individually, which was funny, and Pascal, I think, shared it with me, and then Toure shared it with me, and or our group of friends, and it was written by the young man that's coming on the show tonight, Bertrand Cooper. And in the article he writes for Current Affairs, he discusses the culture industry and who crafts it. So when you think about like TV shows, who writes these TV shows about working class people? A show like The Office that feels so real. It feels like the people behind it had to have worked in an office like this for some time. They had to be these drones that just couldn't go anywhere. When you watch a show like The Office, you always think, like, why did no one quit? Like, no one leaves for a better job? They always leave within the company? And who writes black shows? And ultimately, it's the same type of person. It's elites. And there was a show that we referenced, which I thought this was funny, that when I referenced the show, Bertram tells us that his roommate was on the show. It's called All American. And it's on Netflix. And before I left Oakland, I watched entirely too many episodes of this show, and I would mostly watch it like laughing out loud at the ridiculous scenes I would see, especially when it would try to talk about like gang violence. And I don't know if it was because they were filming in LA, but the gangs represented never wore gang colors. I always thought that was interesting. But that show always felt like a person that has never been to the inner city. That's only like all they know about the inner city is what they've seen in stuff like Boys in the Hood and heard on rap songs. And then they watched Hoop Dreams and decided to make a very Hoop Dreams-esque TV show and just throw in a lot of identity politics and unnecessary drama and make a fairy tale. Like, this could have happened in a magical land. It was so ridiculously fictional. And in Bertram's piece, he definitely talks about the class divisions that happen in Hollywood. A very well-researched piece in Current Affairs. Wherever you are listening to this, there's going to be links in the description to the piece. And then we brought Toure on because when I was trying to get Bertram on the show, and I think he even mentions maybe both reads in the piece, and he mentioned that he's a big fan of Toure. So I'd let, and Toure had shared the article, and I told Toure, and he's like, yeah, I'll come on the show. So it was spicy. It was very spicy. And unfortunately, my co-host was having social media drama. And that definitely comes out in the bonus half. If you want to see slash hear the bonus half conversation, which was amazing. It was fun. It was funny. There's one way to do it. Become a patron. Patreon.com/ This Is Revolution Podcast. Actually, I lied. Patreon.com/ Bitter Lake Presents. Sorry, I've been forgetting that. I apologize. 100,000 apologies. Patreon.com/ Bitter Lake Presents. Again, wherever you're listening to this, there's links in the description. If you want to watch the show and contribute a comment in the chat that we do post on the screen, that we do reference, even when they're not super chats, the best way to do it is probably YouTube. YouTube.com/ This Is Revolution Podcast. I'm right on that one. Again, links in the description. But doing this show 2.5+ hours with Teray, and he's also a friend, and we talk quite often. And as I'm recording this, Teray and I just wrapped up another 2 hours with Ben Burgess. That's 2 hours on air. We spent another hour just... Burgess just sat back and cracked up. So, good times. So, after you listen to this, go watch Ben Burgess give them an argument with Teray and I. That's my music. That's my shut up cue. I am out. Hello, and welcome to another edition of This Is Revolution Podcast. And once again, I am in a different location. I've been joking that I'm on the run. Not quite, but it feels like it. It does feel like it. This is going to be a fun show. I do want to say before I even bring in our guests and my favorite co-host, I want to send a big shout out to Joe Payne of Political Payne, who actually lives in the area that I'm in. And he told me if I ever come out this way, he would take me out. And he took me out to a very nice Central Coast steakhouse. And we had a good old time yelling and talking politics all loud in the restaurant. It was fun. And yes, Gene Bajelan, before I left where I was, fucked up and had to shave all my facial hair off. And I almost look as young as our young guest today. But before he comes in, I have to bring in the man that really needs no introduction. He's probably the reason why you guys are watching right now. He's tearing up the YouTube charts and the audio-only podcast charts with his latest Mau Mau Hour episode. He is the one, the only, Pascal Robert. Please, everyone, welcome Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Jason Miles, thank you for that extended introduction. I am very happy to be with you. I kind of miss you, brother. You know, even though we did a great show this weekend, we haven't had a show in a while. And some reason, the Tuesday show, it feels like a long space between the Saturday and the Tuesday show. And sometimes I'm like, man, where's my man Jason?
And well, everyone jokes about me being on the run. I'm definitely about 5+ hours from where I was. So, and I'm planning on going a little further south. But that's not important. What's important is I made a video. You wrote some words. And in this video is maybe my favorite episode of Good Times. So, look, when I say Good Times, if you don't think about A, how fine Thelma was.
That's a given.
And B, Penny and the Iron, then you didn't watch Good Times. If I don't go, damn, 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 you didn't watch Good Times. So, not any further ado.
Fortune magazine released their annual list of the 100 wealthiest people today, and Bill Gates has been overtaken. By whom, you ask? A Harlem resident named simply Tron. Our Stephanie Gold is standing by with him now.
So how did you become the world's wealthiest man, Tron?
Hot hand in a dice game, baby girl. 6 hours straight, talking about panic, packing it, cracking it, back. Now you're looking at the world's richest man, and I'm black.
Sorry about that, everybody. I guess there was an issue with the video. Pascal, entertain the people while I pull up the video.
Sorry, folks. For some reason, Jason had a little technical difficulty with the people. And I guess it's going to be me and you. I hope you guys enjoyed the last Mau Mau Hour. I was actually thinking about a subject matter for the next Mau Mau Hour that I'm going to pitch to you now. I'm thinking about talking about racial vindicationism and the politics of redemption. It's based on a piece that I wrote a couple of years ago that you can find in Black Agenda Report and Huffington Post. And the thesis of the Mau Mau Hour that we're going to do next is going to ask the question, how much of the Black social or political project is about vindicating the Black identity to the white world? And I'm going to tell you what actually got me inspired to actually do this. Because of the kind of current situation that my ancestral homeland is going through in Haiti, I've been doing a lot of rereading of a lot of Haitian history. And one of the things that I found interesting is that the founders of the nation state of Haiti were very interested in the concept that is very popular in academic studies of Black political thought and Black nationalism, which is called racial vindicationism. What does that mean? That means that their goal was to believe that Haiti was a vindication of the Black race. So my question when we do the Mau Mau Hour is going to ask, how much of Black political thought, how much of the Black political project or Black nationalism or other things in general are dedicated to the belief that Black people have to vindicate or validate or prove themselves worthy to the rest of the world. And what exactly does that say about the Black social, political, and intellectual project when you can actually find segments of vindicationist thought in almost every aspect of Black political ideology? The title of the piece that I wrote is The Politics of Redemption. You can find it on Huffington Post, and you can find it on Black Agenda Report. I don't know what's going on. Jason is still having technical difficulties. I think he's going to be able to show the video now. Hopefully. So, yeah, that will be the next Mau Mau Hour. That should be the last Wednesday of this month. And hopefully we should be able to do that.
Thank you. Could you hear it, Pascal? Can you hear the video?
I can't hear it now. I think we're going to have to scrap the video.
Oh, I guess so. That sucks. But all right. Well, let's bring in our guest. He is the writer of the piece that we'll be talking about today. He writes for Current Affairs. He also looks like he's 10, but apparently he's not. Bertram Cooper.
Hey, what's up? I like that introduction.
And
10? I couldn't even get
18.
You know why? Because you the way you have your camera mounted, there's so much headspace that you look 5'2". You could be 6'8", but
I don't know if I'd be writing what I write if I was 6'8". I would have had a different set of opportunities before me.
And this person, another person that needs no introduction, he is not just a friend of show, he is a friend of real life, a friend in real life. And he is the reason why Pascal and I are together doing the thing that we do. He is the Touré Reed.
Thanks for having me.
You got shots too, by the way.
There it is.
Good to see you.
Whoa.
What is that?
You got Darth Vader voice.
You got crazy Darth Vader voice.
How's this?
That's not better.
Oh, wow. All right, try this.
All the technical problems happen when this many Black people are on the screen at once.
I'm telling you, man.
People always say they say things like, why do you guys have like white people on? Because you don't have technical problems. Now my shit doesn't work through Negro osmosis.
Is it working now?
Yeah, but now you sound far away.
See?
Someone said this is, I knew this was going to happen.
Light skin hour? Is that the one?
Yeah. I knew it was going to happen.
Someone said light skin hour. That is funny.
It is funny. But you know what?
It's the only way I get invited to things is during that hour. Nobody wants to see me during the other hour. It's prejudice.
Reading your piece for the third or fourth time today, getting ready for the show, I had started watching before I left Oakland. I was watching this really horrible show on Netflix called All American. It's a really horrible show. It's kind of the epitome of everything you're writing about. It's a show. It's got not Tyrese. Who's the other?
Tay Diggs.
There you go. Come on. It's got him, and he plays a retired football player turned high school football coach. And it's the story of some kid from South Central trying to play his way out of poverty which is kind of an old narrative because sports nowadays is very, very different than this hoop dreams inspired version of television that I was watching kind of for laughs. But it reads like it's like a white person's idea of what black people are like if they've only watched 90s hood movies and hoop dreams. And I was reading your piece and I was just like thinking of this really horrible show that had these amazingly ridiculous scenes of inner city strife, and thinking about who gets to write, who gets to tell these tales of black poverty, because it sure as hell isn't black poor people or poor people in general.
Yeah, and
I think I tried to make Teray watch that show as well.
funny story, something, there's no way you would have seen this coming. My roommate, Sean Fury, was the actor who plays young Taye Diggs in that show.
No so way.
If you saw the episode where him and the other guy
yes.
get into a fight in high school,
yes.
that's my friend. So the fact that you're bringing this up is just...
That's actually kind of awesome, though.
Yeah. so I haven't watched the show too much other than the coming out party or whatever you call it when somebody is like is on an episode. To your point, though...
We don't call it that, by the way.
Yeah.
But right. it would be really funny if you tell it in Hollywood you're going to a coming out party. They're like, what?
I'm glad you read the piece. 3 or 4 times is very, very kind. But you basically encapsulated, and you got both points in general, popular culture. I mean, one of the big takeaways, or what I hope is a big takeaway from my piece, is that popular culture is an industry made up of occupations. Most of those occupations have an application process. And basically, like every industry that we would consider a desirable industry to work in, especially industries that have things like that we give the moniker of career or a passion, they've decided to use college as the way that they find their applicants. And so given the extremely low rate at which kids who grew up in poverty graduate and obtain a bachelor's degree, not graduate from high school, but graduate from college, you don't get many poor people of any color writing for any of these shows. My interest was more specifically the black poor, because recently especially, there's been all the black watch lists, all the on Hulu, on Netflix, on basically every streaming service, and then also the many magazines, periodicals that have all done what I'll just call the black issue, where they basically put all of their black staff writers up front and center. All of those jobs are college educated jobs. Being a writer at the New Yorker, you really have almost no shot of obtaining that if all you have is a high school degree. And so what I wanted to call out for people is that even though all these black people are being put front and center in terms of pop culture and are being seen as a way somehow to connect with the black poor very, very often, and frequently these jobs are being given, in my opinion, in some way as a response, as recompense, as remuneration for the losses of these poor black communities, the contradiction there is that like the black poor can't get those jobs. And that was really my focus, especially after my experiences going to graduate school, where, you know, I was going in 2014. So every time somebody heard about my background, they were asking me if I had read, you know, Coates, or if I had read this, or if I had read this. There was just this assumption that every black face available to them at Barnes & Noble must in some way be connected to black people from poverty. And pop culture just does not run that way.
One of the things that I found interesting about your piece is that you did something that is very, very rarely done in public spaces, particularly in mainstream majority publications, is that you talked about the way in which class stratification amongst black people affects production of images, ideas, and notions about what black life is. And what was more fascinating to me in a larger context is the question of what exactly is, I mean, there's an overall kind of whole school of thought about what the function of popular culture is in the culture industry in general. But is there a particular utility of Black popular culture in American society vis-a-vis the way in which the political and social establishment of American society deal with the issues, governance, and distribution of resources of Black people? And that's the question that I would pivot to Toure on to ask him that question. Is that, does he believe, you know, is this a conspiracy theory, or am I off the mark, or is there a correlation between Black popular culture and the way in which what we on the left would call the quote unquote ruling class, and I'm saying that because there are some who will question whether such things exist, interacts, deals with, the Black population in the United States. Toure, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, first, you can hear me. So do I sound like Megatron still?
No, we can hear you.
Sound good.
Cool. You sound perfect.
So great. Perfect. So, I mean, I think Bertrand had captured the essence of the answer to that question already, right? I mean, if the culture industry and the people who, let's say, write and produce films, or you find a version of the same thing in music, is staffed disproportionately by people who are from the upper classes, then of course it makes sense that the images and the messages that come through the story and popular culture narrative that some way appealing. And in fact, we're thinking about and appealing to the upper classes, right? That their status. And one of the things I thought was saying about Bertrand's essay from the paragraph one or paragraph two, he makes the point of white numerical domination in the United States, outnumber Black 6-1. And of course, what that means, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, is that pop culture will be necessarily tilted in the direction of the consumer taste of white people, right? I mean, it kind of makes sense that it would work that way because it's the largest market. And I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth when I say that, but at least that was my take on what you were getting at there. And you go on to say something to the effect that for many whites, pop culture becomes a kind of vehicle to connect with Blacks, not so much out of curiosity about Black people per se, but as a platform for redress. And to connect that point, I think, to what Pascal is getting at, and it only echoes what Bertrand had already said, that what we get is these kinds of symbolic victories through pop culture representation and the narrative that representation matters as somehow soothing the wounds inflicted on Blacks today or in the past. So I don't know that I would say it's a conspiracy. It's just an organic product of the class dynamics of pop culture.
Interesting. Bertrand, do you have any thought? Bertrand, you want to have any thoughts? Do you want to chime in on that?
So I do want to say that you didn't put words in my mouth. That is very much why I have that part. Just to emphasize, especially because it seems an obvious point. It's in the word minority. But right now, if you were going on YouTube and look up Netflix as a joke, one of the leading ones, it's just a bunch of segments of Black comedian, has the quote, "If you don't have a Black friend, you're the problem." And you see this fairly often. I want to say it's a Wanda Sykes joke, if I'm correct. But there are a lot of people who really only understand minority as another word for just non-white. So it was pretty important to have that in there and let people know, like, pop culture is always going to be this medium through which the people who do want to participate will say in Black culture. That's where they're going to have to go, because they're not going to all be able to have a Black friend. One thing that came to mind when you were talking about kind of when Pascal was talking about like the distribution of Black people in this way, is that I do very often think that Black people in popular culture, or at least the image of Black people in popular culture, that Democrats more or less depend, and many liberals depend, on their affiliation, or at least their perceived affiliation with poor blackness as depicted on, say, like a show like Atlanta. That affiliation is what allows them, despite also being white, despite also being Ivy educated, despite also not living near people of different classes, they were just those things, it would be very hard for them to really show themselves as distant from conservatives or Republicans who have all those features. But if they can basically distribute connection to the black poor amongst themselves, or at least imply it, it gives them some ground to say that they're meaningfully different from this other group. And that becomes, I think, especially important given how much Democrats depend on, I'll say, the youthful part of the population, which is very motivated to distinguish itself from things that are old or stodgy or just their parents. And this imagined connection to the black poor via the books you're reading or the music you're listening to or the shows that you're watching, I think does that. It gives Democrats a certain image, a certain cachet that they're more radical than they are. And it also allows liberals the comfort of imagining that all of the black poor are already on their side, believe in all the same political bullet points.
Yeah.
It's just a coincidence that we haven't heard from them before, but you know, whoever's on this or that black Hulu show is agreeing with you. So it must be that, you know, liberals have been on the right side of history the whole time.
What's funny about that, because as I was watching the show that your roommate, I really hope your roommate is there right now to hear me talk about this show.
He's not.
Let me text that motherfucker. Anyway,
I don't know.
There was an episode where I really fell down a rabbit hole with this shit too, by the way. There was an episode where there's a black girl in the show. Like they did this thing where they were trying to, it was such a lib show. They didn't want to show all white people with privilege. So they would like always shoehorn some sort of diversity into the privilege. So there's this rich black girl who dates the main character. And she lives in this fat ass house in, I believe it's supposed to be the Hollywood Hills. And after a night where her boyfriend, the inner city kids, like inner city friends had been to her place, it gets robbed. But they robbed it of everything, even the furniture. And my first, who the fuck robs a house in the Hollywood Hills and takes like couches?
What? Somebody what? Thorough.
What inner city hood in LA is running down the Hollywood Hills with a moving truck? And so
you can't fence couches. Is that what you're saying? You can't fence couches. Is that the takeaway?
Have fun with that one. They stole gold records. Her dad's like a producer and they stole all these gold records and all this shit. But the funny part was the whole show was supposed to be like, you thought it was the inner city hoods, but it was her white roommate and a gang of white kids. Like, who the fuck else can get a moving truck in the Hollywood Hills and move that level of shit out of there without someone fucking with you?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, for me, you know, when I, you know, not to be like, you know, rain on people's parade and be like, you know, pop culture is evil and all that jazz. But for me, I mean, I kind of look at this from a kind of utilitarian perspective in terms of how does this affect policy, governance, and perception, you know, not to get all Frankfurt School. But when we look at the way in which black people are depicted in film in the 30s and 40s, we have the kind of step and fetch it kind of Sambo-esque kind of depictions. Then because of Cold War exiges, we get into the 50s and we start to see the kind of noble striver through then, you know, Sidney Poitier, we have Raisin in the Sun, you know, and all of these films change tone. And I think that it would not be surprising to either of us that that's done largely because America is trying to change its overall perception of black folk in the world for the, you know, the utility of Cold War and capitalism and its ability to spread. We get that. But after the civil rights movement, particularly in the early 70s, in the light of some of the commentary we read in the Kerner Commission report on blacks in media and the need to proliferate black images in media, pretty much as a kind of demobilization from the urban rebellions of the late 60s, then we start seeing, you know, Good Times, we start seeing, you know, Soul Train, we start seeing blaxploitation films, and, you know, not to acknowledge too much the work of Torrey's dad, but, you know, he has some very rigorous commentary about how this early 70s explosion of black popular culture really kind of fills a particularly kind of like noxious kind of ruling class intent to create a contained notion of Black identity that politically renders Black people to that same kind of politics of containment. So the question becomes is that, like, in the contemporary age, in this 50-year counter-revolution, right, where we're in this post-George Floyd moment, and we're talking about how the way race is being used, what can we learn, or what does it say about the proliferation of all of this, like, Black trauma porn on streaming services? At the same time, we have all of these foundation-hatched elite Negroes who summer on Martha's Vineyard and go to conferences talking about the racial wealth gap, you know, becoming part of the culture industry and the Black chattering class. At the same time, also, we have the reactionary right gutting voting rights. So what exactly, you know, I don't see any of this as accidental. I think that they are institutional, not necessarily governmental or political, nonprofit organizations, foundations, the culture industry, the various cultural apparatus that exist within the Democratic Party that promote this kind of liberal kind of race zeitgeist in the country. And I think popular culture is one of the main ways that it's being done. What exactly are the consequences of that? Do you agree that that is a reality that we're seeing? And what does it say that more people are not alive to that reality? That may be more of a statement than a question.
I don't know if Tori wanted to jump
in. Well, I mean, again, I'm in the mood to plug your piece. Once again, I think Bertrand kind of speaks to this matter insofar as Bertrand, I think, is pretty clear that, well, I'll paraphrase, I'll use my own words, and this might deviate a little bit from what he was getting at, but it strikes me that in much of pop culture, images of Black folk, which are crafted in part to appeal to the broadest audience possible, are shaped by a desire to maybe provide a window onto the so-called authentic Black. And what the so-called authentic Black experience ends up doing is it collapses distinctions among Blacks, right? It essentially obliterates them. So you can watch, let's say, Pascal's favorite show, #BlackAF, which I will confess, that was sarcasm if you're not clear, because Pascal really disliked that show very much. And I'll confess, when I watched it on Netflix, it was because my father and Pascal, completely independently of each other, over a three-week period, were griping to me about how horrible the show was and fundamentally wrongheaded and reactionary. But a show like that I think dropped at the right around the pandemic, right around the pandemic lockdown. Is that right? I mean, or is that just when I saw it?
I think it was earlier than that. It was before. That show was on before the pandemic. Okay. I remember watching it well before the pandemic even came
out. Well, I didn't watch it until the lockdown because I needed something to do besides sit around and drink beer. And so that was, and that's also a joke, but that was one of the pastimes for me. And it struck me in real time to watch the show, in keeping with Pascal's ongoing complaint about it, that it was horribly tone deaf to the suffering unintentionally, right? Because it couldn't have anticipated the lockdown, but watching it in the lockdown, it was evident that the show was horribly tone deaf because the patriarch in the show equated the problems that he had as a very wealthy Black man with the problems of Black people writ large. And again, I mean, that tendency to collapse the Black experience into one thing, right? To insist that there's a such thing as an authentic Black experience does the work of glossing over not just the diversity of the Black experiences, which is necessary for us to keep track of, right? Because there is not just one way to be Black. We don't have one singular experience, even with racism. But what it does is, I mean, it packages a you know, white audience friendly window onto Black America, because again, the problems that Black people face as depicted in that show really come down to, you know, a large number of white assholes, basically, right? A large number of racist white assholes at the expense of the kind of meat and potatoes issues that affect the lives of, you know, the majority of Blacks.
Hmm.
I don't know why you didn't like Black AF. There were some scenes that were rather hilarious.
The epigenetic take on racism was a narrative that ran through that show that every Black person in America who has some sense of eugenics, let's say, so I'm thinking of one of Pascal's good friends, should have been unnerved by. And I understand that this is part of the popular discourse at this point, but that's what hegemony is about, right? I mean, it's about selling a narrative, of the class of narrative, the people who get screwed over by it. So everybody should take an issue, have some issue with that show, even if you find it entertaining.
Someone in the chat is talking about these like I call them Negro Sopranos shows, Power, yeah. Empire, and all the spinoffs of these shows that are like, we have to show Black success through the lens of drug dealing and entertainment empires that involve drug dealing. And then, you know, you have to have a crazy white boy.
But that's the Reagan story, right? I mean, it's a story of entrepreneurialism. I'm sorry.
Bert. Some of these are taking place in Reagan's 80s. I think 50 Cent has a new spinoff of
Black Mafia Family.
Yeah, Black Mafia Family, which is definitely going to take place in the Reagan 80s. And I think the people that are putting these shows together are looking at the Reagan 80s, aka the crack years, as the golden era for this kind of entertainment. Because even before these were shows, there were these kind of hood documentaries, if you will. I don't know if you guys remember these, where they would have, they talk about guys like Alpo and, you know, all the New York crack dealers. I can't think of their names off the top of my head because I'm not from, you know.
Alpo was from Harlem, and there was another one that was from my neighborhood called Fat Cat. He was very popular.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of them like turned state's evidence. I can't remember which one it was. Somebody snitched on somebody. I can't remember. But you know what I'm talking about? Like, these things became really, really popular. And then BET had a whole series of American Gangster.
Well, let me ask you, Jason,
well, that was a different thing, right? American Gangster was a good show. I'm just playing.
That was different. That was a documentary.
That was the same shit. It was the same shit.
The American Gangster documentary was about Black gangster figures from the early 20th century and early.
Nah, they had regular ass niggas from the 80s. And they had the BMF
within that bitch. Yeah, they had some of those too. I'm not going to deny that. They had some of those too.
That's not Gangland. Wouldn't that Gangland's thing though?
Well, now all of it is like they want to show Gangland. And it's not even like a real gang. It's like they occupied four blocks of Santa Maria, California. They kicked old people.
Every business has got to start somewhere, you know. You start, you get four blocks, and then, you know, you double.
You're building.
Let me ask you guys, as the panel, the question: isn't part of this part of the reflection of the fact, right, that what are considered the quote unquote elders in Black America today are largely Gen X? That basically, you know, a lot of like 50-year-old men who still get geeked about like versus hip hop battles between certain figures. And, I jokingly put on social media one day, it's like, I can't wait till the quote unquote elders in Black America are people whose greatest memory is going to Studio 54 and the Parliament and Funkadelic concert. I mean, like, what is that? Like, the question I'm asking though is that in terms of transition of history, and memory, not to be, reactionary in the true sense of the world, and, you know, wax rhapsodic about the glory days. I mean, I remember that when I was in law school, one of the things that had a very strong impression on me was that I met a man who was a Tuskegee Airman. Like, literally, I was assigned to speak at a function that he was there, and it was impressive. I was like, wow, this guy was a Tuskegee Airman. So I'm thinking today, a kid who was giving a speech in law school is literally like talking to a kid who might be bragging about a dude who might be bragging about that, like, you know, I went to the first LL Cool J concert for Fresh Fest. You know, so my question is that does that have a consequence in how we view these narratives of popular cultural?
Well, of course, because they get to write
blackness and all that.
They get to write the story, right? That's why you're getting like certain types of music in commercials that you didn't have before, because cats that grew up with certain eras of music are able to put them in, you know, punk songs into commercials. Like, I never thought I was going to hear the Buzzcocks in a Burger King commercial and shit like that. Go ahead.
Oh, shit.
No, go ahead.
So the thing is, like, when I think of 50-year-old black people, and you know, I was born in 88, I grew up through the 90s. It's like nobody my age, for the most part, had grandparents or even parents who were particular fans of rap or hip hop culture in any way. All throughout the 90s, most black civil rights, you know, former civil rights luminaries have, you know, quotes of disliking rap, hip hop, the depictions of black people in those ways. That's back when you used to always hear, like, not all black people, you know, are urban, not all black people sag their pants, not all black. There was a real resistance to affiliation with that. For me, and this could be the wrong reading, it seems less like, it seems more about there are black people who can package these sort of hip hop and rap elements and skip over the black community altogether. They don't really have to influence younger black people so much. They can go straight to white audiences to obtain political power and to give a bunch of white viewers the idea that, like, if you watch this particular HBO special, or if you watch this thing, you're connecting with black culture and just reinforcing their own belief on, you know, their particular democratic side. They don't really have to include winning over younger black people. I'm sure there are many young black people who wouldn't necessarily be impressed with, like, somebody. I do think you picked the right example. Someone who is 50 might say, like, I was at the first LL Cool J concert and all that. But to me, in a lot of ways, I find that when I'm talking to, you know, my white friends or whatever, what I'm really filling them in on is stuff that's just obvious and known to every, you know, younger black millennial, and probably to many Gen Z folks. It's just obvious. It's just known. We know that this person is not the king of all black people. We know which music no one's really listening to, but the show told them. And because those black creators and those black figures in popular culture now have, you know, the privilege, if you want to call it that, to just talk directly to white Americans. They don't have to win over black people or black communities or get a large number of black people to agree, like, oh, this show is accurate, or oh, that's actually aligns with their political beliefs. It's almost like younger black people who, or the mass of them, have kind of been cut out of the process to me.
So what you're saying is that, much. I mean, my question is that how much did it really matter in the past?
I would say that you're right. It doesn't. It didn't matter much in the patch.
Saying is that, are you trying to argue that there's less of a sense of collective identity around, or collective black authenticity around what is appropriate or inauthentic or incorrect or the right way to depict black life in your in the younger generations? I'm curious. I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to know if that's the case.
What I'm attempting to argue is that there's one way of looking at how things have gone is to ask, you know, is it because black leadership is different? I think sort of to your point, when you described the elder that you got to speak to and how getting to be mentored by that person, not to put words in your mouth, but having that as the person you look up to might change how someone interacts with politics. And what I'm trying to argue is that in a lot of ways, and it's not that it mattered a bunch in the past, it's that, one, most young black people's opinion continues to not matter. And even though many of them have had experiences that directly contradict what's in popular culture, it continues to not matter. But the difference is that, how do I put it? We're very convinced that it is mattering. We're convinced that forward progress is being made. Many people got to see, you know, Ibram X. Kendi's piece in Time calling this the Black Renaissance. There's this kind of additional gaslighting that wasn't happening in the past. In the past, you might have just been like, Black people's opinion doesn't matter and everyone knows it, but there's this obscuring of it now, and that a lot of the people who get to talk directly to white people, such as Kendi, or the Atlantic's most recent piece, is saying that progress is actually happening and that more and more of the Black voice is getting out there.
Well, so now, what do you have to say about this, Teray? Because I mean, this is something that we kind of talk about quite often in the music as well.
We do, but I was going to ask Bertrand what he thought about, just to elaborate on this basic point, and then I can weigh in from there, that if we're operating in a world in which, again, there's a presumption of a kind of, you know, Black authentic identity, and that's not new, but in which the purveyors of Black pop culture, let's say, are coming disproportionately from the Black upper classes, and white consumers are turning to mass culture for a window onto the quote unquote Black experience. What do you think the broad implications of this framework in which upper class Blacks shape the narrative of what Blackness is about for a predominantly white audience? What are the implications of that for the prospects of a more just society for the Black masses? Does that question make sense?
That question makes sense. I would say that personally, I think it implies not good things for the massive Black. Well, I would say specifically that if we're talking about the bottom of the economic scale in Black America, that it doesn't say good things for them. The Black upper classes is, are so, I mean, according to Pew, it's always like a tie between Black Americans and Asians fighting for who has the greatest distance income wise between their top and bottom. The Black Americans who are getting to create these, you know, pop cultural products, they're at such a distance from the Black poor that even if they're empathetic towards the Black poor, I'm very suspicious that they can use their position to craft an image that's actually helpful to the Black poor. I don't think they're close enough to really know what the Black poor want. I'm hesitant to say need, because that sounds like missionary, but I just think they're at such a distance. Unfortunately, they don't seem to have to confront that very often, because many of them are fully occluded by either Black people from their same station or other white Americans. So they get to just kind of go around thinking.
Let me ask this question to the panel, and especially Teray and Pascal, because you guys grew up watching these shows in the 70s as young preteens. Do you think that because of shows like Good Times, that gets, I think Teray, did you share it with me or did you share it with everybody that interview with Jimmy Walker?
Oh, I think I just shared it with you.
Okay. Teray shared this interview with Jimmy Walker, a pretty recent interview, where he's talking about you can't have another Good Times because of a show about the projects written by white people. And what's funny to me about that is if you fast forward 20 years later and watch a show like Family Matters, and I've said this on the show before, you have a guy like Jaleel White talking about the fact that before he even got on the show, it was so badly written to him as a 12-year-old boy that he found it odd that Thelma Hopkins, this Black woman in Chicago, walks in the door from a long day and goes, "Oy vey."
That happens all the time, of course.
It hasn't changed much. It's like, I'll change the set. So where it might have made sense in the 70s for me to have you going through these great society programs and living in the projects, now we're going to have you, I guess, a middle class family in a whatever suburb in America with the same problems.
Well, and they were going for that, right? I mean, they were, just as the Cosby Show was going for the anti-Good Times. I think Family Matters in a less political way was going for a kind of playing against type, right? I mean, I thought that show, and don't hold me to this, I thought that show was not originally written for a Black family.
No, it was. They literally wanted to get another. This is how lazy that show was, Teray. And maybe I had this conversation with you. the guy, Carl Winslow, I forget his real name, Reginald Vell Johnson, I believe is his real name, is a cop on the show. You know why? They were like, get the guy from Die
Hard. Die Hard. Yeah,
and that makes sense. Made him a cop on the show. That's lazy.
He already nailed that part. But, you know, I mean, I'm glad you asked this question, at least in the broadest sense, because I was thinking about Good Times and, you know, based on inspired by Bertrand's response. And I was going to ask him, and again, I'm happy to talk about this. If given thinking about the class divide between the Black artists, cultural purveyors, if you will, and, you know, the Black working class and poor, I wonder if there is a matter of if we can witness kind of life imitating art in some of these shows where the Black purveyors of culture themselves are removed enough by spatially, thanks to their class privilege, from the quote unquote Black community, because they grew up in Beverly Hills, actually, that their sense of Blackness is itself shaped by mass culture. Rather than their personal experiences with Black Americans. And the connection for Good Times for me is that that was a show that I grew up on, of course, to my parents' dismay. On the one hand, my father and I have been watching Sanford and Son together or reminiscing about episodes since I was about 3 years old. So that was remains one of our favorite shows. And I was certainly happy as a kid to see all of these Black shows in the 70s, though it wasn't so much because I was looking for faces that looked like mine, because I grew up in Southwest Atlanta, so everybody was Black, right? So all I had to do was step outside my house, I'd see Black faces, or look at both my parents, and that would work too. But Good Times was a show that my parents were not crazy about, and were even conflicted about the Jeffersons, because Jimmy J.J. Walker's kind of breakout role resonated, well, rubbed them the wrong way, because my parents would have, like many middle-class Black parents in that era, shared the same view of the JJ character that John Amos and Esther Roll had of JJ, which was they saw him as a stereotype and was a character that really resonated with the consumer taste of white audiences. And from the vantage point of my parents and the parents of some of my friends, when I walked around saying Dynamite, it horrified them, because again, they saw JJ step and fetch it. And the last thing in the world they wanted was their 5-year-old kid or whatever to imitate step and fetch it and to have a step and fetch it like character as a role model. Now, if you grow up, I had the advantage again of living in Southwest Atlanta. So everybody was Black, right? But if you grow up in a predominantly white neighborhood and you watch good, and so you don't know a lot of Black people, your parents, your cousins who may live elsewhere though, right? Aunts and uncles, and your principal window onto Blackness anyway, besides your parents' role modeling, is pop culture. And of course, the reason I'm gonna say that that might be your principal window is because your parents are old and you're not really thinking about them, you know, at least in relation to you. And you're not necessarily thinking about them as role models in any sort of conscious way, or even an exciting or subversive way is probably more like it. And kids like to be subversive. But more to the point, your friends, your white friends, are taking from their understanding of Blackness from Good Times and then all of the television shows that follow. Then, of course, the expectation is for you to play a part, right? Because all social life is somewhat performative. And so between the images that you see on TV that represent Blackness that are shaped by Norman Lear in one era and a class of upper class Black, you know, purveyors of culture. And of course, the notions of Blackness that your white friends are exposed to, right? Your classmates, your teammates, et cetera, are all coming from, you know, mass culture. Then I wonder if what we see as Black culture so frequently is actually in some part life imitating art.
That's a really great question.
I would say that there definitely is that feedback loop. I think One of the interesting things just about like what you're describing, you got to grow up in an area that was largely Black. I find that when you have large communities of Black people, they feel rather comfortable being dismissive of mainstream popular culture. I think a great example of that, for example, is basically how enclaves of Black people were able to hold on to their own distinct beauty standard despite being exposed to endless images of very skinny white women and heroin chic and all of that. So even though the mainstream is going completely against their image, when they're surrounded by other Black people, they feel very comfortable dismissing that. They also have each other to kind of define Black identity. The other element of like, we know that classes operate in certain areas. And so you have the large numbers of Black kids who do make it to college, and especially elite prestigious colleges, and then go on to write these shows. They're coming from experiences where they are very often surrounded mostly by non-Black people, very often mostly fellow white students. And they kind of, in my opinion, have this choice before them. You know, they live very similarly to their peers. They're economically very similar. They may be in neighborhoods that are nearly adjacent. They're going to the same school, but they can't be white. They can't have an identity that's valued in the same way and accepted in the same way. There's this other identity that white people are very intrigued by that is captured by popular culture, which you mentioned. And so I do think many of them get to see that the one Black identity available to them that they can take on, which will be authentically Black as far as their white peers are concerned, and that even if it comes with some negatives, has at least some positive, you know, built-in social attributes, Black cool, Black athleticism, Black radicalism. If they adopt what they're seeing on the TV, they have a chance at that, an identity that their peers will accept. And so I do think that influences them. I also think, how do I put it? I noticed in researching for my piece how many of these Black creators were formerly, I don't know if there's a better term for this, but they would describe themselves as nerds. They weren't just outside of white culture. They were outside of Black culture in a very specific way. Some of them have stories of when they did go to schools that actually featured other Black kids, and all the other Black kids were basically like, you're not Black the same way that I am, which is not a view that I subscribe to. But there's this real outside observer status among Black creators. They're basically given the freedom to observe poor Black culture, filtered obviously through media lens, because, you know, rap videos are not a documentary. But they're given a pass. They're allowed to just observe and then try to recreate that and also take it on as their own identity. And all of this is assumed to be fine because they're also Black. But the alternative, at least for a college age kid, is like, well, you could not act like you love hip hop, but then you're going to be a white Black guy, or you're going to be not like other Black people. And you might be getting that from both sides, because if you leave the college campus to try and go slum it down the block, those Black people are going to notice that you're not from that area too. So not a lot of options.
What's more relevant to me in terms of the utility of the Black cultural production, particularly in today's society, is that what happens when Black pop culture begins to literally propagate certain types of political worldviews as being the solution for Black problems, Black capitalism, i.e. as the agenda, or, you know, like buy Black, or, you know, more Black banks, as if these solutions haven't been tried before, and as if there isn't a particular reason why such politics are being propagated, particularly in a time when the agenda for a more class-based political solution to the problems of Black folk has at least been elevated by certain factions of American political discourse. So, like, what exactly becomes the case when Black popular culture serves a very clear political purpose in that regard?
Don't answer that, because Pascal's on the clock. Yep, he's not looking at the clock. You know why? Because he's been distracted. I'm calling you out, man.
your screen. I'm not distracted. I want to lead to the Patreon hour. I know
that's not what you were trying to do. I know when you're trying to do that, and that's not what you were trying to do. You were trying to get the end of the show question.
I watched the time before I asked the question.
Are you? I don't buy that. You were trying to get the end of the show question. We are going to the bonus patron half of the show because you get an hour for free. And like a great, great rapper that I believe was a person of color once said that the game is to be sold.
The game is to be sold, not to be told. Wow. That's an interesting.
True story. I read it in the Iceberg Slim novel.
Iceberg Slim has some interesting novels, man.
Yeah.
Pimp.
Trick Don't Baby.
Remember. Trick Baby. Also made into a movie.
Also, Iceberg Slim has a documentary on Amazon.
Damn good documentary. Were you into Donald Goins' novels?
There was Iceberg Slim. My stepmom had a really interesting book collection. So she had like Revolutionary Suicide and the Communist Manifesto and like Trick Baby.
Interesting.
It's always interesting to me when people, I know that it happens all the time. It just never stops being fascinating for me to compare.
I mean, that, like was, how that was my shit back then, right? That was like, you know,
yeah.
You go to a black person's house now, I'm sure you go to somebody's mom's house and you got a fucking a Terry McMillan novel on the shelf. So that is just the times they are changing. So we're going to the bonus patron half. We're gonna continue this conversation. Also, we're gonna have a talk about redlining. And because I love you guys, and because I pay for it, or we pay for it. We're gonna do the call-ins. We're gonna take some calls.
Wow.
We're gonna take your calls. If you want to talk to these two wonderful light-skinned gentlemen. We're not going to fuck with last time you guys took forever to call. You guys are acting like little punks. Fucking here. Let me give you the number now on the free half so you know to call it. On
Tori is like, you didn't tell me anything about no calls, man.
Yeah. We're calling.
You changed the format since the last time I was on the show. And they added game show music, too. 70s game show.
70s music and Penny and the Iron. Someone said, so LME, I will say this before we get off the air. She said, Jason, why did you put that footage of Penny and the Iron on that show? And I will say it again. I saw a meme when the Delta variant was fucking shit up, and it had a picture of young Janet Jackson as Penny, and it said, my fall plans. It had a picture of the Iron, and it said the Delta variant. I couldn't stop laughing. So when I found out we were doing this show, I made it a point to shoehorn Penny and the Iron in. There you and it took a long time to find exactly Penny and the Iron.
That's diligence.
So on that note.
It's got a rhythm like Benny and the Jets, though, so you're messing my head up. And you know, the only version of Benny and the Jets that I've ever enjoyed is Bismarcky's.
Brilliant.
The late great Bismarcky. You know,
shouts out to the homie Bismarcky. I still miss that guy. His passing, it really hurt. I hadn't talked to him in a little while, but Bismarcky was a wonderful individual, and you're going to make me get all emotional at the end of the show. And really, really sad that he passed. And hip hop lost a true giant. And what's really sad about it, you want to talk about like black culture and hip hop, it's sad that we lose so many of these legendary artists to like diabetes.
Mm-hmm. It's not funny, man.
He's not the only Heavy D. Black Rob passed away as well this year. Shock G. You probably wouldn't have
that heard. Bad year for Gen X.
Not bad year for Generation X rappers, boy. Oh, bad 2 years.
It's been rough. I saw somebody talking about they were a Tupac fan. They tried to emulate Tupac. You would not have Tupac if you didn't have Shock G. You wouldn't have Bay Area rap the way you have Bay Area rap if you don't have Shock G. So that was a some catastrophic losses in the culture industry. And on that note, I will leave with some sad music.